So we don't do this every week, but every now and again, we like to bring in a special guest. And now that we've been doing this for a little while, we might start doing that a little bit more often. And tonight, excited to have with us Mr. Phil Ajarapu. I always feel like we know each other well enough. Yeah. I should never butcher your last name.
Ajarapu.
Ajarapu. Okay, yeah. There you go. I was in the ballpark.
Yeah, totally. Better than the principal I had.
I can only imagine. Principals and like every junior high athletics coach.
I know, right?
Like it's like those guys have a special, like I feel like they sort of, maybe it's a
my
like
high
a gag.
School gym coach, Julian Emanuelson, he called me Ajapur.
Yeah.
Ajapur. Like the R's at the, no, Ajarapu. Like,
drop and give me 40, Ajapur.
Drop and give me 40. Well, Phil, like one of the reasons that we wanted to have Phil on is Phil is a musician. He's got a record out right now and has been touring the country in support of it. Tonight, he'll be dazzled by the fruits of my garage. So,
yes.
which
is the, really just beer,
beer and
is hops a fruit?
Yeah, I would say
fruitish. I don't know,
but we do always kind of throw the make our special guest do tell us a story a la the cold open that we usually start these.
And I was curious if you might could tell us anything about B.B. King.
Absolutely. So I was playing in this band, Liquid Soul. That when I was a kid and was listening to them, I was really enamored with them. So that when I finally got to be their bassist, it was pretty much the hottest bass gig you could get if you were a bassist in Chicago, which I was. So when I got the gig, I was just like, how did this even happen? This is amazing. And we got to tour around and go to other countries and whatever. And then it quickly became obvious that this gig was taxing. I was the youngest guy in the band and the only one with a driver's license. But then you do things like, you know, go to different countries, which is cool, or open for B.B. King. Like, so we got to open up for B.B. King in like 2005 or 6 at the House of Blues. And we got to our green room at the House of Blues in Chicago. We'd played there before. And we go and we play our set and we walk off stage and we had to walk past him. And we all gave him, like, a wide berth because, you know, he's a friggin' legend. You don't want to be, you know.
Well, and those guys are just known to start swinging at people, right?
The blues guys?
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe. Not the old ones.
Like,
but
you want to know why I'm sad? Because I kick a lot of ass.
he'll hit you with Lucille. Isn't that the name of his guitar?
Yeah, that black ES, whatever he's got. Yeah, that would not feel good, probably. Although it is hollow.
Anyway, I'm sorry. I'm derailing your story. So you gave him.
So we walk off stage. We walk past him and give him a wide berth. And I'm the last one because I'm the farthest away. And he just ignored the rest of the band. And then I walk off stage and he shakes my hand. He's like, "You're a fine young bass player." And I'm saying that in like Chef's voice, which isn't quite his voice. But, that's the best I can do.
It's blues guy.
So he shakes my hand. And all I can think of is his hand is so soft. This is not the hand of a blues man. These are not calloused working hands. Like, his hand was baby butt soft. And I'm like, I was just totally weirded out by that for...
You probably don't want to bring it up either.
No, it was like shocking. It was like, wow, man, what do you moisturize with?
Can
I
be more gnarled?
Yes.
Yeah.
But I kind of wanted to be like, can I get some of whatever you're using to give to my girlfriend?
Oh, sure.
Is that inappropriate?
Well, no.
All right. Okay.
Depends on how it landed, but
I mean, softer hands are always...
Did you close it?
These hands are so soft. No, I mean, he just kind of like... He shook my hand, not like super firmly, not weakly. He didn't give me a wet fish, but I was just like, wow, his hand is so, so soft. And so I'm like, thank you. And everyone's like looking at me like that he complimented me because all the guys in the band were great players regardless of their other problems
offstage. Don't forget where you are, but did you feel like he should be walking around with like a radio, like a railroad tie and a piece of Robert Johnson's hair? Like, what was he supposed to, like, how are...
Yes, he came directly from the crossroads to the gig. Yeah.
Well, I mean, like, I'm 37 now, and I was, like, in my late 20s then. And so maybe my first thought or my first memory of B.B. King was, like, from Rattle and Hum, where they're doing Love Goes to Town. Like, because I was... I don't know, 11 when that movie came out?
Yeah.
So that's probably, and I was like, wow, he was old then. Like when you're 11, everyone's old. you know, here I am in my like late 20s. I'm like, wow, he looks kind of the same. But yeah, I don't know. It's like when he speaks, his voice is so like,
you're a fine young bass
player. Exactly. So rich. His voice is so rich and sonorous. The hand was incongruous. So we watched them from the side of the stage. They burn through the set. The players are really hot. Mostly he's sitting down, but every now and again he'll like play a little solo. But the thing about him is it's like he only has to play a few notes and you know instantly, oh, that's B.B. King. It's like Santana. Like some people just don't have to play a lot of notes. Like whatever it is, it's in their hands and you hear that person's personality in the guitar. It's the creepiest thing. It does not make any sense, you know? Because most people pick up a guitar and it sounds like a guitar, but it's like they pick up a guitar and it sounds like them. It's just totally weird to me.
Yeah.
So then he finishes his set and we bail for our green room to get out of their way, right? And then they walk into our green room. And we've played here before and we're like, why is he in our green room? And then he walks through a door that like none of us have ever noticed and never tried to open into his green room, right?
It's magic.
And it's a much larger, nicer green room. And I'm like, wow, House of Blues is holding out on us.
The VIP room.
Exactly. So like the door's kind of cracked open and his entourage is in there and he's like, young man. I'm like, me? He's like, yeah, come here. He's like, I don't have any booze to offer you because I'm diabetic. I don't drink. Would you like some cheese and crackers? And I'm like, yes. So I'm having cheese and crackers with B.B. King in his green room, and the door is still, like, open. And the rest of my band is, like, staring at me. They're just giving me the eyes. Like it's a combination of, like, you're going to die. Screw you. Are you going to invite us in? And he's so, I don't know, like, aware. Because under his breath, just between the two of us, he's like, you can invite them in if you want. What do you do then? You know, I'm like, if anybody heard that and I don't do it, I'm dead. I'm so dead.
Maybe there was another trap door that you could just
slink out of, right? So I'm like, hey guys, come meet B.B. King. And so then it just turns into this like huge party and there's lots of people and he's signing photographs. I still have the photograph that he signed framed. It's one of the few things that's made its way through the tragic explosion of my life. That, my vinyl collection, a signed picture of the raspberries, and that's about it.
That's a cool story. I mean, if you're going to eat cheese and crackers with anybody, it might as well be.
Yeah, I know. It's just, like, so weird that, like, he picked me out. He's like, I was, like, he was trying to win me points with my band, which he did.
Yeah.
And it worked.
Yeah.
Like, he saw all this tension, and then he just, like, did me a solid.
That's cool. I have to tell, we've got to get on with the show soon, but it did remind me of one fun little brief anecdote, which is that you mentioned Santana. Mm-hmm. Several years ago, during South by Southwest, I had occasion. There was some club that was opening up and some promoter or whatever invited my wife and I to sit in a special section for a show. Like,
right.
I kind of remember who some of the acts were, but it's not really even that part's not important to the story. What's important to the story is we ended up sitting in between Ben Harper and Salvador Santana, and they put us down in this section, and we're both – our minds are just kind of instantly blown.
Not who's Salvador Santana.
Carlos
Santana.
No, his son.
Oh, his
son. Oh,
Sal. Gotcha.
Yeah. And so the deal was is that we were sitting there, and they were like, you could sit here for as long as you want while this is all going, but if Lou Reed shows up, you got to go.
Well, of course.
And so we were like, I kind of want to get thrown out by Lou Reed, but anyway, he did not show up. And I was reminded of this story this week because the World Series has been going on, and Santana and his son Salvador, who sat next to us at that South by thing, were playing the national anthem in the San Francisco baseball park. But the funny thing is that the way that the cameras were set up, I guess Salvador was on keyboards and his dad was on guitar.
Okay.
And they only showed his dad and Salvador's arm. It's like, that's what it's like to be the son of a famous, iconic guitar player.
Yeah. Do you think that's worse than, like, say, Julian Lennon, who looks just like John Lennon?
No. Well, yeah. I don't know. I feel like that we could go down the deep end rabbit hole on
kids and their kids famous dads.
Whatever. Yeah. Harper Simon and whatever.
Yeah.
Anyway, This is Somebody Likes It. I'm Kevin Newsom.
I'm Ryan Newsom.
And our special guest tonight,
Phil Ajarapu.
We'll be right back. And we're back. I guess we ought to talk about, first of all, where
the
Shane
elephant
is.
Elephant not in the room?
Yeah, exactly.
Oh. Where is Shane? Well, he's, I mean, sick, right?
Yeah, Shane is under the weather and can't join us tonight.
The text that I got said that he was, quote, sick as fuck.
Oh, so we can say the F word.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. We encourage it.
Yeah.
Oh. So, thank God. Well, shoot, we should redo that whole opening bit. Then.
That's all right. Well, we'll go back in and drop in the F-bombs later.
Right. Just throw in random fucks.
Fix it in post. That and the, what is it, Shine.
Yes.
But yeah, so Shane can't join us tonight, and that was one of the reasons that we figured no better time than the present to bring Phil in and let him tell us stories about B.B. King and cheese. And now we want to talk a little bit about the album that we're going to cover tonight. Shane actually picked this record, and so sadly he won't be here to share his take on it.
The discussion.
Well, now we can just roast it without him.
Let's just mostly talk about Shane.
Yeah, all right. Yes, exactly. And then we'll play Taps, and then the podcast will be over.
Yes.
anyway, no, this was a crazy record to record. The stories have been legendary. Ryan, you know, your initial thoughts on reconnecting with Loveless?
Well, you say reconnecting. I never really knew this record. I have a vague recollection of riding around in one of your old cars and listening to the cassette of it.
Yeah.
So it's really me just, you know, communing with it for the first time the last few days. And, like, I'm not sure I get all the hype. Like,
yeah.
I mean, it's considered this sort of, you know, legendary piece of art that, like, you know, I heard it and I was like, that's pretty good, but it definitely sounds like of its time.
Yeah.
You know, and maybe
does it really, though?
It does to me.
What else in 89 when they started recording sounds like it?
Well, Curve, for one. You know, I was
some of the 4AD bands, yeah.
I was a big fan of the record Doppelganger by Curve. And maybe it's because I heard that record first, you know, many, many years before hearing this one, that, you know, it would be hard to catch up to it. And, I commune with that record at a very impressionable age, you know, when I was in my early 20s or late teens. It reminded me a little bit of that and a little bit of, like, the first Smashing Pumpkins record, Gish.
Which was 91 when it came.
Yeah,
sure.
Yeah, so it would have been right around that time. I do, you know, imagine that it was, you know, incredibly innovative for its time, but, you know, there was a whole slew of bands that were doing this kind of thing right around then. But My Bloody Valentine seemed to be sort of leading the pack.
Well, and I think it's fair to say, we've talked about this in other podcasts, that, you know, music is by its nature inherently collaborative, and so you can't really, it's very difficult, especially, I would imagine, especially given not only the type of music that they're making here, but the environment that they're making it in, to, like, not sort of be influenced by other things and influence those around you. Mm-hmm. And there, you know, certainly that has been true in the intervening years since. But I did find one thing I wanted to share. I did find a really great piece. One thing that's interesting about this record is they did a re-release in 2013 prior to their most recent
album
coming out. Yeah. And one of the outlets that wrote about it is Grantland, which, you know, writes about primarily sports but also some pop culture stuff. And so, anyway, there was a little snippet about how this record came together that I thought was kind of, you know, a nice table setter for what we're going to talk about tonight. And I'll just read a little piece of this article that was written in Grantland. It says here, as anyone familiar with the record's oft-told legend will tell you, Loveless was recorded in 19 different recording studios over the course of 2 years. Shields hired and fired a battery of engineers.
Kevin Shields.
That would be Kevin Shields.
Yep.
Not Brooke Shields.
Not Brooke Shields.
Yeah. Hired and fired a battery of engineers in a maniacal pursuit to capture the sound rattling in his head, and in the process spent so much money that he nearly bankrupted his label. This might make Shields seem like some kind of single-minded weirdo visionary in the mold of Brian Wilson or Sid Barrett, but Loveless was merely the work – this is – this guy editorializing a little bit. But Loveless was merely the work of an imaginative sonic architect who trial and errored his way into inventing a whole new way of guitar, getting a guitar-based band to sound. And so there are certain kernels of that that I think are kind of inherently true, but also...
But it could be revisionist history?
Sure, it could be. And I mean, you know, the 19 studios in 2 years sounds like that's pretty much etched in stone. And so that doesn't sound like... That doesn't sound like... Somebody who's not sort of figuring it out.
He ticked off like the two major engineers that like stuck with him through it. That he actually was like, you and you, you can work on this. And then like one of them was like, oh my God, I couldn't take it anymore.
Yeah.
God, if I owned his label, I would just be pissed.
If I owned his label, I just would have nipped that shit in the bud.
Yeah. Well, and they ended up, they actually ended up doing
it. At some point, you throw so much money at it, you know.
And you only sell 225,000 copies? I mean, come on.
Yeah. Well, and it's funny, too, because I do think that this is one of those albums that, to this end, gets credit for, you know, it's like, if it's a movie trailer, they're saying, well, it sold 225,000 albums and spawned just as many bands. Like, that's kind of the,
right.
You know, the gist of the zeitgeist on this record, is that,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. Is that...
So that Curve album,
it was an influencer.
It came out March 92.
Okay. So you know, this preceded it.
Yeah. You know, that and, like, My Bloody Valentine was kind of loosely a band from, like, 83 on, and it had released another EP before that, and released another album, I believe, before that.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, it's like... and if there are other bands doing stuff that are in the underground that are doing similar stuff, that's fine, you know... But, like, listen, you know, think, I mean, geez, 89. I mean, just the 80s in general were such a miserable time for popular music. Well, not to say that My Bloody Valentine was ever, like, popular.
Well, no, and the point's been made that Creation, their label, was essentially, you know, they were trying to carve their own little niche in the buying public, and so they were intentionally putting out, like, they got behind some records that didn't have a place anywhere else.
Right. And so, you know, as far as, like, other aspects of the album, like the kind of, like, vocals being really buried in the mix and kind of it being swirly and whatever.
I have to say this. So well, finish where you were saying.
You know, like, the Cocteau Twins had done that kind of stuff, too, but it's just, like, I think, and I'm coming at it from somebody who really, like, I did have a relationship with the album, and I loved the album, and then listening to it today, I was like, I still love it, I think it's still important, I think it's still essential, but I don't think it's essential for the reasons that I thought it was essential when I was a kid.
Yeah.
I don't think the songwriting's very good.
That was kind of my problem with it, is that the songs aren't necessarily, it's sonically memorable, but
yes.
Like the songs themselves... I'm never going to be humming this.
You know what? And that's the thing. As a guy who really loves songs and really loves albums, like, this is not where I'm at now.
Well, and I think it's fair to mention that much like when Shane is sitting in the chair where you're sitting now, Phil, like, he's a lyrics guy, and he is a, like, he
melody
writes.
Guy. He's a melody
he, yeah,
guy.
He writes melodies and pop songs.
He's so good.
Yeah, and so, like. So to that end, like, I feel like you're kind of cut from that, from a similar cloth in that way.
Yeah,
like,
absolutely.
So yeah, that sort of lack of structure, I think, that there is in this record, I would think would be not disquieting, but like, yeah, but it wouldn't feel like it was in your sweet spot.
Right, and that's the other thing, like reading about the album today where Shields was like, he and Belinda spent a lot of time on the lyrics. I'm like, why?
Well, the
you can't even understand
I them. Know. It pisses me off.
Also, I think that sounds to me like a little bit of bullshit. Like,
I agree.
One of the things that I called from the Wikipedia entry on this was that, like, most of the time they would come into the studio.
No lyrics written.
They would have no lyrics written, and then he would sing some shit. They would bury it under mountains of guitars, and then she would try and essentially, like, remember what it is that he had sung and go write it down. Like,
right, or be inspired by what he had said, or what she thought he had said.
Right, yeah.
And then
what she thought he had said.
Right. You know, I mean, he even admits, like, numerous times in print that, like, oh, yeah, I think it's really interesting watching people try and figure out what I said. Well, if you spend so much time on the lyrics, just tell us what they are or mix them so we can hear them. Except for the fact that even though the songs aren't good, the album definitely has an emotion. It's got a feel. It's like, for me, it was weird listening to it in the daytime. For me, that's a nighttime album. And to me, it's like, I never ever did listen to, like, song. It's not like when back in, like, mixtape culture, mixed CD culture, when you'd make those things, I would never use any of those songs because to me, the whole album is one song.
I could definitely get behind that.
It's you a know, mood. It's yeah, a mood it's, piece. In this way, it's like almost. It's almost like classical symphonic literature.
To me, it kind of seems like it might be like a good record to clean the apartment to.
Yeah, yeah, sure. You
know? One of these. I don't remember which article it was that I read, but one of these reviews said like it's definitely not something that you want to listen to while you're washing your cat. I was like,
that's really specific,
and like probably, you know, a little obvious. Number one, if you're washing your cat, I don't know what the fuck
something has already like, gone wrong.
Yeah, exactly. And where your cat, you have the weirdest cat of the universe. So we might be to the place where you know what? Let's
play a track.
Let's play a track. Let's jump in and do. Kind of the one of the signature tracks off this record, the one that leads us all into the rest of it. Let's play a little bit of Only Shallow. Here it is.
Word.
Okay, so that was Only Shallow, and I did find the bit that I was alluding to earlier, which is from that same Grantland piece where he says, it's impossible to clap along rhythmically with a large group of people to Loveless. And although you could totally do that to the first part of that song.
Sure.
And you definitely don't want to put it on while washing your car. Maybe I read
you
that
said
as cat.
Yeah.
I like your version better.
My version is funnier. And then he says, the guitars approximate the sound of a Pontiac Grand Am being sawed in half.
So, like, that's lovely. Yeah, what a great image.
A little bit of that's kind of
it actually
true.
Reminds me of Kevin, our mutual friend Miguel, who owns Nomad, was also the
bar here in Austin.
One of the owners of the club that I started out booking. He described the other owner, Kyle's taste in music, who Kyle was very much into metal, thrash metal, what have you.
Yeah.
He described Kyle's taste in music as the sound of a washing machine being dragged behind a pickup truck.
It's almost hard to believe that club didn't work out.
Yeah.
Is Nomad gone?
No, Frontier Bar, the bar that is no more.
Yeah.
On to a new frontier.
Yes.
But anyway, yeah, so that was the opening track to Loveless. I feel like it's probably the one that's the most iconic, and it might be.
It's a great way to start an album, and the snare hits, and then all of a sudden, it's like they're off to the races.
Yeah. Well, and the funny thing is right, like they take those big, swirling, angry guitars, but the rest of the song is like are those muted vocals that sort of float along under that that sea swell of churn. And I don't know. I think
I like what Heather Ferris from AllMusic said. If you don't mind. Ooh. She says, Kevin Shields and Belinda Butcher's vocals meld perfectly with the trippy sonics around them, suggesting druggy sex or sexy drugs.
All right. I
feel you on that.
Yeah. You know, one thing that we haven't really dived into
now,
yet.
Were they a couple? Does anybody know this?
No, nobody knows this. I haven't seen any confirmation of it. But
yeah, I don't know. That's a good question.
But I mean, I bet they were boning.
They were close enough that she tried to write down the things that she thought he said.
And he was okay with that, which means he was probably getting some tail.
I don't know. I think one thing that we haven't really talked about in any great detail yet is...
You said tail.
Yeah, exactly. We're all five. Is the shoegaze thing.
Phenomenon.
Yeah, and like... I feel like My Bloody Valentine is like kind of the poster child for that idea.
Man, but there are a lot of those. Like the flagship band of that movement.
Well, I mean, like, I mean, say what you will about whether it's a good album or it's not a good album. Like, I think it's a good album, but again, I'm going to say I don't think it's good songs, but I don't think shoegaze is about songs. You know?
It's about like a feeling.
Right, but yeah. They engendered it in such a way that like the bar was really high from the get-go.
Let me ask you a question, Phil. Like, do you feel like that... that with shoegaze bands in particular, like if we accept that a shoegaze band is a shoegaze band and there's whatever, like they fit in that bucket, do you feel like it's difficult to put, because this feels like a live sonic experience that doesn't sound like a live record that's been pressed onto a record, for lack of a better term. Like, you know what I mean? Like
that it feels like immediate?
It feels like it's best enjoyed live,
yeah.
but it's been recorded canned.
Well, I mean, that's the thing. It's like I listen to Loveless, and it still feels powerful. Like even if you have it like on fairly low and you've got earbuds in,
sure,
it's an assault, you know. But like, and I love Ringo Death Star. They're so much fun to see, you know, here in town, local shoegaze band. You watch them live, and you're like, you're just absolutely destroyed by the sheer volume,
right?
But you listen to it on record, and it's like it doesn't have that immediacy. It's like so. There's something that I can't quite put my finger on, some kind of intangible that makes this album an album. And I think that's part of why it took him 2+ decades to come out with the next album.
Right? I don't know. What do you think?
Well, I felt like I should have been stoned.
I feel like if you're not stoned...
If I smoked weed, I would probably enjoy this record a lot more.
Yeah. I think it kind of like... It's like the oral equivalent of drugs. And some albums are like that. It's just like... If you put it on and you let it go...
Well, to be fair, I did get the feeling that, you know, this would definitely be a rewarded... repeated listenings, you know, would be... yield further rewards.
I don't like long albums, and to me, this is an exceedingly long album.
Yeah. No,
well, I mean, like, if you look at it on paper, like, it's almost 50 minutes. For me, I like my albums in the, like, 30 to 36-minute range.
Well, and one of the things that we... And that, I think, given your aesthetic that we talked
Absolutely.
About, like, totally makes sense. I think one of the things that we talked about briefly off the air was the idea that, like, you really have to sort of, like, if you know that you're going to sort of critically dissect this record or at least discuss it, you kind of have to pay attention to what song is playing when, because they do intentionally fuzz one
right
into
each
other.
Together. I think it's one big piece.
Yeah.
I think it's symphonic.
So, I will. I'll share one last little bit from this Grantland piece. I just thought it was. I thought it was written sort of in the modern day. It was written in the modern day after the re-release came out, and so it has a little bit of hindsight in it. And these guys also tend to have a little bit of fun with their subject matter, and I thought this was kind of a nice way to encapsulate further what this record feels like. Which is to say, he says here, listening to Loveless is not unlike the sensation of having just endured a 2-hour sonic hurricane, then feeling an intense yet melodic pounding in your eardrums for the next week, and I mean that in the most pleasant way possible. Imaginable. What took so long for Shields to find in the studio was the ecstatic pleasure point buried in the suffocating psychic evisceration caused by pure unadulterated volume. On most rock records, the music drowns out the lyrics. On Loveless, the music drowns out the music.
You know that he and Belinda both had to take a break from recording their vocals because they both got tinnitus?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I believe that.
Does that happen?
From live shows, not from the studio, from live shows. And then, you know, like And then he was like, oh, that's, you know, tinnitus is like, you know, it's Butkus. It's imaginary. I'm like, but you're suffering it.
Yeah.
The guy is crazy. He's he's full on bonkers.
Yeah. Well, and then when they played here, they hit Austin on their on the tour that I guess that they did in support of the MBV record not very long ago and a couple, you know, last year, year before last. And they played the Austin Music Hall for the – and if you don't live in Austin, then this may not be as interesting. But acoustically, true or false, Phil, like Ryan, that room doesn't – like it's there's not like a lot of sort of sonic protection in there.
No,
like,
it's reverberous.
Yeah, so I would think that –
it was
on,
exceptionally loud.
On one hand, like, yeah, everybody that came out of that place, like just anecdotally what I heard about that show, and I did not get a chance to see it, was like it was really fucking loud. Like really loud. So, and anyway, and I would think on the reverb side, they would actually think that that was probably a good thing, but those guys are going to be
I read somewhere that, like, the Guinness Book of World Records had rated them the second loudest live act ever.
Who's
the
first?
Loudest.
Yeah, I don't know. Exactly. I don't know. Dinosaur Jr., maybe, having seen them, I would say maybe Dinosaur Jr. Maybe Mogwai.
I don't know. That's don't know. Really interesting.
I don't know what to tell you.
By reputation, I would wonder.
Dinosaur Jr.'s brutal. I'm not going to lie. I love him.
So, so bread, it sounds like, sorry, and bread is short for rye bread.
Rye That's, bread.
Yeah, a
yes.
little bit of brother parlance.
Kega.
Yeah, thank you. It's all of a sudden, we're all three. Anyway.
What's a muggy?
I don't know. Your other takeaways, I mean, what do you think? Like, we can't obviously, Shane's not here to speak on his own behalf, but I mean, like, you guys have known each other for a long time. What have you know? What has he told you about his taking this record?
As far as I can recall, he really loves it. Like I knew that both of you were familiar with it. I knew that both of you were fans going into this. So I've been flying blind a little bit. But Shane was a little bit of a like shoegaze geek back in the day.
How old is Shane?
He's 4 years old, which is really remarkable.
He is 40. Yeah.
So I'm 37, so he's 3 years older than me. So he would have been a senior in high school when it came out?
Yeah, I think that sounds about
right. I mean, Jesus Christ. I can't even, like, as a freshman in high school, man, 91 was a good year. Like, I went through junior high of being like, oh my God, fuck all this shit. Fuck all this horse shit. And then 91 came around, I was like, oh my God. It's like, well, what a sea change in music.
Well,
like,
do you think,
can you imagine what that was like for him as a senior in high school to be like, oh yeah, I was a freshman and it was like fucking Unskinny Bop and now I'm a senior and it's Loveless and Nirvana's Nevermind and Blood Sugar Sex Magik and Pearl Jam's 10 and Primus Suck on This and
but I would also,
who even
I would
knows
also
what else?
That, yeah, I mean, we're all, one of the things that I've kind of learned from us doing this podcast is that there is a tendency. Like, it's sort of hard not to, what is it that Louis C.K. said that we quote from time to time? It's like, dads always dress like the last year that
they
were
cool.
Yeah. So, like, I feel like sometimes, like, the music thing, we all, myself included, like, we all get caught up in that, which is it like.
To that time when music was the most important thing on earth.
When it really meant something and it was really transcendent. And now we're older and jaded. And, like, it's harder for us to get to that place where we're truly surprised by something.
Mm-hmm. I think maybe part of it, too, is education. So, like, when you first start putting on music as, like, this thing that you define yourself by, like, this is the music I listen to, this is the music that I found, this is the music of my time, this is the music I learned how to drive to, you're going through all these changes. And you're figuring out who you might become as an adult, and so this music is the soundtrack to you growing up, and then you grow up,
right?
And then you I think part of it too is knowledge. Like the more you know, the more miserable you become, the less happy you can be. You know, so like when I was a kid. I loved so much
knowledge, man.
When I was a kid, I was just like so happy to find music, you know, because. But then as I got older, I thought more about, like, because as you develop opinions and you figure out, this is good, but this is better. Well, why is it better? So you start defining your own metrics or your rubrics by which you subconsciously or consciously judge the art that you digest. As you get older, if you think about these things, then you're like, well, now the bar's higher and the bar's higher and the bar is higher.
Mm-hmm.
And so less things hit that bar. And maybe that's growing up.
So that may be true, and I might have to sit down just a second and dissect what you just said. But still, we're kind of almost at the point, Ryan, where we can throw on another track here. But I'm kind of thinking maybe why don't we go ahead and do the intermission.
We'll do our
section we call A Few Minutes With, where we take a totally different song and we
this
have
is
a little
a
bit
really
of
different
that.
Song.
So
it is
different.
It is a very different song. but we'll come out of that. We'll talk a little bit more about My Bloody Valentine, Loveless, and then we'll play, and then we won't talk about it too long before we can get into another song because I want to share some more of the music. But for right now, stick around for a very special intermission.
So tonight's A Few Minutes With. We are spending a little time with a song that really just has nothing in common with My Bloody Valentine's Loveless. And that is...
It is a 180.
It is a complete 180 from Loveless. But that is Skilo's I Wish.
I sent Phil a text message earlier today, and I was like, oh, hey, by the way, we do this segment in the middle of the show that we call A Few Minutes With, and we pick a totally different song that's totally unrelated. And tonight... It's Skilo.
It's really unrelated.
What did I text back?
He sent me back a note that just said, whoa. and that would be the appropriate response.
Yes.
So, anyway.
But I fucking love this song.
Everybody loves this song. Find somebody who doesn't.
It's like the... I remember it was so refreshing at the time because this was right when we were in the thick of, like, you know, gangsta rap.
It was 95.
Everybody was talking about how hard they were.
Man, 95 was the year that everything went south at the Source Awards, and then 96 was the year that Biggie and Pac died.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it was right in the midst of all that. Here's this, like, the world's only self-effacing inner-city rapper.
Whoa. What about Young MC?
Let's see, Young MC.
Think about Busta
like
Move.
Busta Move. That's not self-effacing.
But
advice.
I'll jump in and add a little bit of context. I mean, one of the things that we've talked about in other shows where we did Paul's Boutique and we did the NWA record that broke them. So
right.
And managed to not use the N-word the entire time.
Yeah.
Good job. I'm glad.
So one of the things that we're one of the things that struck me that I knew you would talk about, Ryan doesn't like it when the acts yell at you. And
it's
so
true.
He was like, I feel
well,
like
the
Beastie Boys are always yelling
Paul's
at me.
Boutique.
And then, you know, whatever. And then Cube just said, like I'm going to shoot you. Like, that's happening. I'm going to shoot you in the face, especially if you're a cop.
What about when Dre's like, don't make me slap you in the face with 9 inches of limp dick?
Well, maybe. Right, yeah. I mean, like, same deal. But the thing is like, clearly, this guy is like, I can't buy a brick. And all essentially the entire song is a list of the things that are sort of working against him.
I know, right? I kind of love that.
It's charming.
He's, like, cheerful about it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
What about Biz Markie? And, like, you say he's just a friend or whatever, right? Like,
sure.
He goes to her dorm and sees the other dude.
All right. All I'm saying is it's rare because most hip hop is like,
to a level
yo,
that other
I do
don't.
This. Like, I'm a fucking bad motherfucker, and here's why.
Right.
Here's a list of how badass I am.
I wish two things would happen. One, that there was a song that was, yo, I do this, and that song consisted of a list of the things that he does.
It probably exists.
I'm paraphrasing, of course.
One can dream. Anyway, yes. And then when we were watching this, one of the things that Phil said was like, how tall is this guy? And it occurred to me...
He is not tall.
Well, no, he's
is
not
he,
tall.
Is he, or did they just find really tall guys to sit next to on that park bench?
Even when he's not next to large dudes.
Hollywood is more or less the amusement park of professions. And so the deal is, I think that, like, you know, this accounts for the career of Tom Cruise and several other mainstream actors. You can only be so tall. So in order for him to star in his own video, he had to be as short as he is. That's the way that I'm looking at it.
You know, I met Trent Reznor once.
Yeah.
And that is a very, very short man.
Yeah.
He's like maybe 5'1".
That guy's so tiny that when you walk up to him, you think, maybe I'm far away.
I felt like I could, like, toss
objects in the mirror are smaller than, larger than they appear. Exactly.
I felt like I could pick him up and throw him, like, a pretty good distance.
Oh, apparently he's 5'8". Okay.
Trent Reznor?
Yeah.
Skilo.
No.
Oh, Skilo.
Skilo is 5'8", which is not tall, but I mean, it's not. He's
well,
not,
he just says he wishes
little
was
women.
A little bit taller.
Yeah.
I mean, 5'8 is not baller height.
No, well, unless you're Spud Webb.
That whole song is about, like, not being able to reach something on a shelf. Like, it sounds like maybe that's what it could be about.
I mean, sure. Don't get me wrong. Like that chorus is so catchy.
Yeah.
But what the fuck is up with that rabbit in a hat
with
a bat line?
I think it just fit, you know?
One thing that he is really good at that a lot of rappers these days aren't good at is he'll take the rhyme over the bar line. So he'll rhyme something, and instead of like, da-da-da-da-da-da rhyme, da-da-da-da-da-da rhyme, he'll be like, da-da rhyme, da-da-da-da-da rhyme, and like it'll land in odd places.
Sure.
You know? In a way that I feel like has been lost with a lot of MCs this day.
Is that your way of saying he has flow?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, I concur.
All right, guys. Well, this has been a few minutes with Ryan. Anything else you want to interject about
the self-effacing thing? Is a great point.
No, and that's
it was maybe
super refreshing at the time.
I think that might be why it still is current.
This song sounds fresh to me still. Like, and I like if this comes on the radio, and I'm not typically listening to stations that play, you know, this type of music. But if for whatever reason,
music?
I'm cranking this thing up. Yes, Negro music. Yes.
Oh, good God.
Yes. No.
I saw a clip of Oscar Peterson as a jazz pianist on Dick Cavett. And like, and he's like getting Oscar Peterson to like play through all these piano styles. And all of a sudden, he's like, tell me about block chords. Or are they black chords? And I'm like, whoa, he said that on TV. What's going on?
I
felt so uncomfortable, and I'm not even white.
Trailblazer Dick Cavett.
Yeah. Yes. But I feel like that's the third time that Dick Cavett has come up on this podcast.
I know it's at least twice, because I did an impression once.
Yeah. Anyway, I don't.
Sorry.
So if you're wondering if we're bleeding edge, the answer is yes.
Yes. We're right on the edge of 1970.
Anyway, Rye, so you chose Skilo. I'm with you. I think this song's a fucking hoot.
I love it, man. I crank this thing up if it ever comes on. And
nobody turns this song off.
Yeah. Nobody goes like,
nobody puts
that's
baby
played
in the corner.
No, never. But we've got to go back. We need it's time
Can
to go
back.
Back
to some impenetrable squealing guitars.
It's not impenetrable, but we should go back. What I'm going to do first is play a clip off of from I Wish, and then we'll head back into a little bit more of My Bloody Valentine.
Sounds like a plan.
Coming
I'm
up.
Disjunct.
We're taking calls on the wish line, making your wacky wishes come true.
Hello? I wish I was a little bit taller. I wish I was a baller. I wish I had a girl who looked good, I would call her. Wish I had a rabbit in a hat with a bat and a 6-4 baller. I wish I was like 6'9", so I could get with Leo. She could, she don't know me, but yo, she's really fine. You know, I see her all the time, everywhere I go. And even in my dreams, I can scheme a way to make her mine. Cause I know she's living fat. Her boyfriend's tall, and he plays ball. So how am I gonna compete with that? Cause when it comes to playing basketball, I'm always last to be picked, and in some cases, never picked at all. So I just lean up on the wall, or sit up in the bleachers with the rest of the girls who came to watch their man ball. Dag, y'all, I never understood black. Why the jocks get the fly girls, and me, I get the hood rats. I tell them scat, skittles, kabobble. Got hit with a bottle, went to the hospital for talking that mess. I confess it's a shame when you living in a city that's the size of a box and nobody knows your name.
So that was I Wish by Skilo. Again, a diminutive self-effacing inner-city rap artist.
I felt like, well, we talked about that ad nauseum, but fun, happy, like little perfect
fun, happy laundry list of why some things in his life suck.
Well, I mean, beyond that, like kind of a little perfect circle of a song, like sort of the exact opposite of what this, you know, intentional, melodic, and sometimes dissonant miasma that
My Bloody Valentine
put together.
Yeah. a maelstrom, if you will.
A maelstrom.
A very good word.
Well, and the funny thing is, if you spend any time reading reviews of this record, it becomes like game within the game to figure out like how many different words people can use to describe sonically what this comes across like. And it's
because
hard
there's
to
no
do it
hat
well.
To hang on. Yeah, I mean, there's nothing to hang your hat on. Yeah. You know? It's an assault. That album's an assault.
Yeah, and I don't know if I necessarily want to be assaulted by my music, but...
Well, you know, sometimes I like it
that
rough.
That does actually remind me of a joke, if I may.
To tell.
Two peanuts walk into a bar, one was assaulted.
Oh, God. Yeah. Who's the dad now?
I'm like a dad without a kid.
Yeah, that's all right.
At least that I know about.
Pause for effect. And go back to the show. So anyway, no, I thought that was cool. I think one of the other. So we are long enough into this podcast that we haven't played as many tracks or shared as many tracks as we typically do. And before
it's
we play
my
one,
fault.
Oh no, it's all good. But maybe
a Jerpo,
maybe a little, maybe
a Jerpo,
Adjipor. What are you doing? Dropping give me 40,
Adjipor. Yes, if we could get Phil to give us 40 during the podcast, we would do that. But we're not going to do that. So
that's great radio.
It is actually
listening to somebody attempt to do push-ups.
It's like, ow, I'm tired. But the other song that gets a lot of play and gets a lot of discussion individually,
and rightfully so.
Yeah.
Can I ask this real quick? Does this record have a single?
No, no singles.
Yeah,
no singles, no image of the band, and no text on the cover. They just drove their label absolutely up a wall.
Well, and
sure.
I will say that
no
that
interviews.
Technically, that's true, but I did have a. Not only did I have this, and whatever, just dating myself. Not only did I have this entire record on cassette, but I also had a cassette single, which on one side was Only Shallow, and on the other side was Soon. And I was like, "Holy shit, this record's amazing!" Like. And, like, you don't get any of that. The funny thing is like, they'd intentionally... I assume that that's what Creation had done as just
right.
a fuck you. Like,
stop
we're going to take... Yeah. Like, we have to figure out a way to make some money off of this. But I thought, like, they still feel like these sort of long, lingering explorations of what's going on there. But,
so you had a single where Soon, which is a seven-minute track,
yeah,
is the B-side.
Yeah.
Seven minutes!
I know. It's like almost a jam band. Oh, that's the other thing that...
You know, Stairway was eight.
Yeah, well, and that's the other thing, too, is like... and this struck me funny, and I read it in a couple of places, that Trey Anastasio from Fish...
wanted to cover this album for Halloween.
Yeah! Like... And it was, he said that it was his favorite album of the 90s, which tells me a couple of things.
Drugs are bad,
like,
okay?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Thank you, Mr. Mackey.
Yeah. One of the things that it tells me is that, like, that, you know, that guy just likes long, meandering explorations.
Surprise.
Like, I know.
Well, Fish likes to meander.
Shocking.
And actually, right. Something that occurred to me, and I don't know if it would be the kind of thing that most people would normally think about when they're checking out this record, but it's not entirely unlike Free Jazz, which, as Kevin knows, I sort of have a problem with. Like,
yeah.
it's not my favorite type of music. It just
I like
song structure. I like, you know, give me a good bridge.
But yeah, I agree too, as a musician, but also as a music fan.
Yeah, well, and I do think, Ryan, it's at least a little bit funny to me that you are, I wouldn't necessarily call you averse to this record from what I've heard you say.
I'm not averse.
But you're not enamored with it, and that's fair.
I'm dipping a toe in the water.
It's not how you, it's not as good as you remember it having ought to have been.
Well, I just, it's legendary.
It is legendary. And
sure.
Legendary is.
And so, man, that's a lot to live up to.
That's a lot to live up to.
Well, and I guess you can't microwave legend, right? Like, you can't sort of.
I mean,
you can't microwave legend.
Don't even look at it. But it's like.
I hope so.
I mean, like, let's be honest. Like, pick a random legendary album, you know? Like, you know, fuck Velvet Underground. There, I said it.
Oh, man, I want to punch you in the face.
Yeah, punch me in the nuts instead. Then we'll get somewhere. But like every legendary album is a potential sacrificial goat.
Well, sure, to somebody it's going to be a letdown.
Sacred cow.
I mean, here's where I was going.
How does it live up?
Here's where I was going in my setup, which is we have, you know, last week we you know, we endured your – not endured is not the right word, but we witnessed your warm embrace of Electo Pura.
that's a good way to – warm embrace. Yeah. Yeah, there's no way you guys could like that record as much as I did.
Right.
Another band that Kevin Shields has an attachment to.
Exactly.
That's true, actually. Yeah. Kevin Shields did a remix of Autumn Sweater.
And worked with Primal Scream. And, like, for somebody who is supposedly, like, Syd Barrett, Brian Wilson crazy – he's fairly prolific, just not with his band. In which case, you know what? I'm just going to go out on a limb and be like, you know, this like whole like Syd Barrett, Brian Wilson, I'm a genius thing is fucking bullshit. And he's really just like the Axl Rose of the indie rock world. And that MBV is the Chinese Democracy of the indie rock world.
Well,
it took even longer.
The album MBV.
Yeah.
The Chinese Democracy.
Exactly.
Well, you could certainly make that. It took 22 years to put it out. Like, sure.
Yeah, you know, and I read that too, but I think it was really only 21 because it came out in 12.
Oh, my bad.
No, I think the internet lied. I know, the internet lied? Well, the hell you say.
Well, but the point being is like, if that were a person, it could drink.
It could drink. Like, I know. Kevin Shields is 51 right now. He was 26 when he started recording Loveless.
It's crazy.
That's half his lifetime.
All right. Well, let's do this. Let's get right into Soon.
Which is a jam.
Yeah.
Not going to lie.
Which is
I dig this song.
Man, the drums are killer. It's like New Jack Swing before New Jack Swing.
All right. Here it is. This is Soon. So that was Soon, and I think one of the things that people, the way that that song typically gets characterized is as the dance track to this record.
Oh, I was just boogieing my ass off.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I know, but this was the one that played in clubs, right?
Like, right, and yeah. You know, it's like that whole British rave culture, you know, that spawned Massive Attack and the whole Manchester beat, and you know, you ever saw 24-hour party people?
Sure, Happy Mondays, and
right,
yeah.
Happy Mondays,
all that shit
in spiral carpets.
Yes.
Yes. Which
notable mostly because Noel Gallagher roadied for them.
Yeah. Right. Talk about a
and
guy.
And Primal Scream is part of, you know, like all that stuff like is kind of like where dance and
lots of drugs.
Dance, drugs and rock. That's where they all meet.
So are you channeling Bill Hicks?
A little bit.
Real high.
Real high.
Yeah. Yeah, I back in the day when I had a colleague in Manchester, I always wanted to get them to send me a factory T-shirt. I mean, I'm sure that there's got to be one.
You could probably order one online,
or just make it.
Yeah,
and it would just look like nothing. Like it's just a square.
Just reminds
building.
Me of
like,
the old Fugazi T-shirts because you know Fugazi famously didn't sell any merch at their shows,
yeah.
And so people started printing shirts on their own that said "This is not a Fugazi T-shirt."
Yeah, it makes sense. But anyway, I mean, impressions of Soon.
It's a jam. What a way to end an album.
Yeah,
yeah. I mean, it's the one song that really stuck out to me immediately on like first listen, going like, all right, I can get behind this.
So, do you feel like
it's a jaunty little ditty?
It is for this band. It is a jaunty little ditty.
Well, yeah, and then maybe that's why it sticks out. to me, but you know, that's certainly something I could, you know, if I were attempting or I just bought this record and I wanted to, like, you know, it'd be the first thing I would latch on to.
Yeah.
To me, it's funny how this track is kind of like the bridge between, like, the guitar rock that it inspired and, like, hip-hop.
Yeah, no, and one of the things that Phil pointed out while we were listening to this, the song earlier was that, that the drum beat is...
It's basically New Jack Swing.
Yeah, like, and essentially, like, and if you would have told somebody off the street... Who's
who the hell is My Bloody Valentine?
Right, exactly.
Yeah, but another thing that's interesting about the way the album was recorded, if we're gonna believe everything that Kevin Shields says, and why would he lie? Dude's too crazy to lie. You know, like people think there are way more guitars on this album than there actually are. It was just like how he mic'd them, and like he did a lot of stuff with the tremolo arm on his guitar. But like the drummer, had an injury, and so he played some stuff and they looped it. And you got to keep in mind, like, 91 when it was released.
Yeah.
That's 4 years before the Intel Pentium chip.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So whatever computer they're working on...
Comparatively primitive.
Well, and I do think...
Well, what was your computer like in 89,
90, 91? It was an Atari 2600 or whatever.
Yeah, you know, I was learning to type on a... So I was learning to type on a Radio Shack TRS-80.
It was a game of Pong and some obscure shadows. No,
That's the thing. By 91, we were still like 3.5 floppies. I don't trust them. They're so small.
Well, I do feel like I got the impression listening to this record that somebody recording it, and I don't... How many engineers were there?
19 studios.
Studios. Yeah.
That's the other thing. When they went to go master it, they went to this studio and they bounced it to like some tape machine and it went out of phase. So instead of one day to put it together, like Shields had to do it from memory and it took 11 more days, which just sent the label just through the roof.
What I was going to say is listening to this record, it occurred to me like somebody out there really likes George Martin. Like, I mean, just some of the, you know, back masking and weird effects and...
Right. And George Michael.
Or George Michael, sure. Yeah. This, you know what? This
the
really
Georges,
is,
the two important Georges. Yeah, forget
like, really,
George Harrison.
You go from, like, Wham to this, like, in one easy step.
That might have been hyperbole on my part.
I did not make that leap. That said, I think listening to this... 20 some odd years in. I mean, it still sounds, even if it sounds of its time.
23 years in.
I know. It's crazy.
I think it probably can be still sound of its time and still sound fresh, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, no. I mean, it certainly sounds of its time and origin.
I think that's because of everything that inspired that followed it. Like, if it hadn't made its impact, we'd go back and listen to it and be like, whoa, this is way ahead of its time. I think
if it hadn't made its impact, it'd just be forgotten.
You listen to, like, Can. Does Can sound like it was happening in the 60s or the early 70s?
Right.
You know?
Krautrock.
Exactly. And yet, it went on to have some impact way after. It's like you listen to Franz Ferdinand in 05, and everyone's like, oh, disco punk, how original. And then you go listen to Gang of Four in 79 on Top of the Pops or Old Grey Whistle Test, and you're like, oh, hey, Franz Ferdinand, 20 years in the past.
Right. Yeah, essentially it's thrifting.
Interpol ripping off Joy Division.
Yeah.
Right, but with worse lyrics.
Yeah.
Sure, right.
Man, their lyrics suck.
So I want to make sure that we get in another track before we wrap things up. And
Phil is losing a lung over here.
Exactly. So before Phil takes the dirt nap, let's go to...
I Can't Be Killed. That's been established.
I want to have a band just so I can call an album Phil Takes a Dirt Nap.
It's just allergies. It's no big deal.
All right, good. Before we get into this, one thing that I did start to call out earlier that we didn't end up, we kind of segued out of, was that Phil... hi, Molly.
Phil's dog is here.
Yeah.
Sorry.
So, and she's really quiet, but I think she's ready for us to start wrapping it up. Anyway.
Sorry about that.
So one of the things that that happened earlier today was that Phil got around to listening to this record and then posted about it on Facebook.
I did.
And so the first thing that happened was I was like, slow down, killer. I was like, you had to save some of the good stuff for the podcast.
I think I did.
But you did.
I was channeling my thoughts, corralling them.
But beyond that, one of the things that bubbled up out of that conversation was another mutual friend of ours popped up with a link to the Wiki lyrics site, and it was like, God forbid you would have to be the poor soul who had to mine
had to
all
sit
the
down and figure out what the fuck they're saying.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, just like, what kind of punishment would
you
that
know?
Be?
I kind
of
wonder if you put a gun to Kevin Shields' head and said, "What are the lyrics?" Would he know?
No, of course he
would
know. Yeah, although I suspect what would happen is he would tell you very confidently what they were and that he always knew, but inside he would go like, "I don't know. I had no idea."
Like, dude, he makes Michael Stipe sound like he's got perfect diction.
Yeah, yeah. No,
well,
crazy.
You're talking about '80s Michael Stipe, but yes.
Pick a Michael Stipe. Pick the most unintelligible Michael Stipe. Kevin Shields sounds way drunker.
All right. So on that note, let's play To Hear Knows When.
So that was a little bit of To Hear Knows When, which, if I'm being honest, like, kind of bleeds into the rest of the record as far as I'm concerned.
Well, one of the things that struck me about that piece is it's a little floral. Like, it feels like it's a... Like, it's
go
like,
on.
It's, well, I mean, like, I feel like the sort of the, yeah, the top line of that song is like a little... It's designed to be a little bit of a change of pace. And it, you know, to Phil's point earlier, it's still recorded at the same pace as most of the rest of the record. But sonically,
yeah,
it's one tempo. But sonically, this plays a little bit of a higher register. So I thought, I thought it was interesting.
I thought it was interesting too that when they went on tour, they got a flute player to cover some of those things.
Oh well, of course that makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. All in all, guys, like, we're kind of getting to, you know, close to the end here.
Let's talk about how he's Irish and probably drunk.
Okay.
Kevin Shields?
Sure.
Yeah.
And what is it that Kevin is shielding himself from? So
I was wondering what his rap name would be.
I think he's shielding us from himself.
Well,
and that's why he hasn't really released a lot of albums.
I don't know. I mean, do you think it's at least... I'm always curious about these things, like sort of the tortured genius idea. Like, if the guy is just incapable of doing more than being what he is, or if it was just sort of a perfect storm where... He got into music at a good time when he was young. They moved in a direction that had not been beaten to death yet and created some things that were interesting and had some staying power. Or if it, you know, I mean, if it's a, is it a nature or nurture deal? Like,
man, you know, that's a tough situation because, like, let's take it back to the Brian Wilson thing. You know, he did Pet Sounds when he was 23, and what has he really done since? He laid in a
Kokomo.
Bed. Jesus. You know, his nurse.
Right. Captain Ron.
You know, that's the thing. Like, the Beatles were done, and, like, George Harrison, at the youngest member, was only, like, 26 when the Beatles... 26 when the Beatles broke up.
Yeah.
Can you imagine being an ex-Beatle at 26?
Yeah. McCartney was 27. Ringo and John were 28. Like, what? Oh, shit. Now what?
Yeah, right. Well,
wings.
Whoops.
I mean, you know, on one level, and we won't, you know, sort of sidebar into a whole Beatles chat, but I do think on one level, you got to think, well, lucky me. Like, I'm
but
so
maybe
not,
like that whole like creative thing happens when you're young. Maybe it's like being a music fan. You like more music when you're young, and as you get older and you get more informed by what you learn, you're just like, oh, and you,
do you take less chances as a result of being more informed?
Well, maybe it's also you know what you want. You're more informed about what you want. So because you know what you want, you take less chances, and you're willing to take less risks.
Well, I'll tell you what. I saw REM probably 5 times, and it was over a span of like 15 years.
Right.
And the last time I saw them, they sucked. Like, they were phoning it in.
Yeah.
Like, just going through the motions. And I love that band. It pains me to say that. But, like,
my producer
when
was
I saw
a touring
them
member
in
them.
1989, they were fucking amazing. You know, when I saw them again in, what was it, like, 04, whatever it was, like a lot less amazing.
Well, you know, maybe it's just tough to be amazing when you're old. Tired.
I mean, you know, like, you know, but you get that sweet spot, you know, when you're, you know, maybe, you know, 26, like
37.
Mr. Shield was. Yes.
Like I am.
Well, listen, we're rounding this out. I do think.
Final verdict on this album?
Well, yeah. I mean, we don't necessarily always end them with a final verdict, but I think it's fair to say that, like.
I think it's essential, but not for the reasons that I thought it was essential when I was 14.
Well, and I think that's a prescient observation. Like, it's nice to be able to sort of step out of your own history and sort of re-examine something in that way, and that was nice. I don't think it's not a snapshot record. Like, it's not a record that you can listen to casually.
It's not a singles record.
It's not a singles record. So to that end, I enjoyed the opportunity to sort of re-examine it. Shane will be rejoining us next week. I want to make sure and thank Phil for sitting in.
Thanks for having me.
Crying out loud, this was fun. We'll bug you again. Oh,
and we're going to have our next guest next week.
Well, and before we get to that, and I do want to get to that because he's here, and I'm going to let him drop the knowledge.
Oh, Christ.
The album for next week, you mean?
Yes. But I did want to... I did want to say Phil's got a record out called Sing Along Until You Feel Better. You can get it on iTunes. And
Amazon.
Who produced that
Spotify.
Record?
Ken Stringfellow from the Posies, Big Star, REM.
Yeah.
I finally have vinyl. That only took 6 months. You know, I'm going to actually have a vinyl release in the calendar year I release the album. It'll be the last Sunday of November at Spider House Ballroom.
Sweet. Very nice.
So
very
if you're
nice.
In Austin... Around that time, Crying Out Loud, come out and see Phil play. He's a fun set. And the record's great. I really enjoy it. So
4 stars in AllMusic. What?
Yeah.
Tell you what, man.
Thanks for joining us, dude.
Thanks for having me.
And we won't get into a whole thing here, but my friend Mark Cubion stopped by, and he's gonna join us next week. And Shane should be back. Hopefully, if he's still laid up this time next week, we might have bigger issues. Yeah.
Well, hopefully, you'll have a whole new batch of phlegm.
Oh, excellent, excellent. But we're gonna let Mark pick next week's record, and he's picked a doozy. Mark, what are you gonna share with us?
Well, I would first like to say that I haven't started it yet, but I will be releasing a vinyl record next week. Yeah, it's,
show tunes.
Stringfellow will be producing it as well.
Yeah.
That's the requirement.
That guy gets around.
I do have a lot to do before next week, but in the meantime, I've tasked these guys with going back and sinking into a record that I think that they're all really, really familiar with and very proud of as one of their favorites, and that is Meatloaf's "Bat Out of Hell." So we're going to be checking that out next week.
Yeah, I just threw open my mouth a little bit.
Oh, my God. All right, well, brace yourselves, America, or at least anyone listening to this podcast. For our guest, Phil, for our friend Mark who stopped by, this is Somebody Likes It. I'm Kevin.
I'm Ryan.
We'll see you next week.